Welcome to the Lifetime Athlete Podcast, where you can achieve peak performance at any age. And hey, you're awesome for being here with us today. You kick ass, you rule, you rock. Always know it, never forget it. And this is John Zombro, Coach Jay-Z, along with his amazing co-host and broach. That's Bro Coach PK.
Jay-Z, what a vibrant and ecstatic start this morning. You have the energy flowing through you.
I'm friggin' feeling it. And what we're doing is we're putting personality back into the podcast.
Were we lacking that? I don't think you were lacking that, my friend.
You know what? You are the wind beneath my wings, but I ain't going to sing that one.
Fair enough.
Okay. So this is episode number 87. And the title's an interesting one because it is Hunters, Meat Eaters, and Athletes.
Yeah, John, that's interesting. How did we arrive at this topic?
I had what I would call a non-peyote-induced vision.
Do tell.
Just a few days ago, I was standing on a mountaintop, knee-deep in snow, on a crisp, perfectly clear, and still late November day. The temperature was in the single digits, but I was surprisingly warm there in the sun. And this was partly due to the steep climb that had precluded my reaching the observation point, but it was also due to the sensations I was experiencing, those of fulfillment, calmness, gratitude, and acceptance. And that those things pervaded my being. I really enjoyed the opportunity to allow my thoughts to flow and linger as they might. So you could say I was being mindful. And this was the genesis for today's episode.
Keep going. Tell me more.
Okay. So I was out really on the last elk hunt of the general firearm season here in Montana. And, you know, it gave me a chance to reflect on the season and also how those topics of hunting and athleticism and meat and the human experience all sort of blended together.
Okay. Gotcha. I'm tracking.
Yeah. So whatever you want to call elk hunting, whether you see it as a sport, a passion, a pastime, pursuit, it's one of my favorites. It's something that I really look forward to every year. I probably consider it my peak season or in season. I train for it and I just relish in it. And it's all based on respect for the mighty Wapiti and its abilities and the environment that it takes me into in that quest.
Absolutely. Well, and also sort of harvesting, fuel and nutrition and food for your family as well.
Yeah, generally, I've been known as a provider in that category. But if I was keeping score this year, I'm going to put it at Elk 15, Jay-Z 0.
So you got an offer this year.
So we have, just to explain this to folks, some of you are probably aware, we have an archery season, which is 5 weeks, and then there's kind of a week off, and then we have a firearm season, which is 5 weeks. So over the past 11 weeks, I've been out 15 times. So 15 days, I trekked the mountains and just couldn't quite get it done. I got close to some animals, but just, particularly when you're, in the archery mode, you really have some restrictions as far as ethics goes, what kind of shot you might want to take. And so couldn't get that done. And then, just during the rifle season, we had some, early winter, some changes in weather and animal patterns. And I was always a step behind, to say the least. And, I'm not totally done yet because we do have kind of some later season, they call them shoulder seasons here, opportunities to fill the freezer. And, I'm hoping to do that to go along with the beef that I have on order. But yeah, that's where I'm at right now. So a little bit of humor there is, I got a lot of miles of walking and hiking and steep climbing and thinking time in, and I'm not saddened by that at all.
Right, right. And I think, just to paint the picture even further. So when you say this is your peak season, I just want to set the table for the listeners who may not have a window in how you've done this, but this is your, when you say you've been out 15 times, these are substantial you know, big days, you're in the mountains, you're in snow, you're climbing elevation. So it is a, you know, a very vigorous form of hunting. This is not a, you know, you're pulling your pickup onto a, you know, a field, or you're not driving, you know, roads. You are, it's a physically demanding pursuit for you, in addition to being one of your passions.
Absolutely. You're talking about 10 to 15 mile days, mm-hmm. off trail, in snow, side hill, you know, up and down, probably as much as potentially 10,000 feet vertical change in an outing like that. And, you know, carrying 30 pounds, you know, of, you know, gear, which is necessary in the backcountry every time. And so that's something that I find that training for is essential, because then I can do it and be effective and enjoy it without getting destroyed. You know, there's that comment. And the last thing I'd say is, it's just such an amazing opportunity to get out there and have that rekindling of the, you know, kind of a primal tradition. And yet some of us modern folks who do it, we really cherish that.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I personally am not a hunter, but I observe that in, you know, my friends and acquaintances who are passionate about it. John, let's double down a little bit and talk about, you know, man, and maybe expand that to mankind as a hunting athlete. And let's look at it through that lens, because what you just described is, that is not casual. I mean, you know, the possibility to gain, to travel up and down over 10,000 vertical feet in a day is, that is substantial. That could be just one day that someone could train for. And you're talking about doing this multiple times, double digit times over the course of the season. Talk to me about that. Do you think about it as a, you know, mankind as a hunting athlete?
Yeah, I think you have to be, if you're going to do it that way. And so, you know, hunting the backcountry, whether you're hunting for sheep or goats or elk or deer, among other things, you know, it does require you to look at training and then, you know, recovery and nutrition and fueling. Very important to get that done. And then if we go back in human history, you know, and whether we're going, you know, beyond backwards in time, past Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, there's several more. Over 2 million years, hunting really has been the primary source of food procurement. And that's very true until, you know, the last 10 or 12,000 years, which was the advent of agriculture. And even more so over only the last several hundred years in many places around the earth.
And that's just a fact. So the idea that, I mean, it just goes back. It's literally in our genetic code, our DNA.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, in modern times, you know, I think we have another thing that you alluded to, the mankind word is, you know, those gender roles have been removed. So it's not just guys who are doing this now. We have, you know, I know several women hunters. I know there are a lot out there, and that's great. You know, I think we now can, you know, make sure that this is open access for everyone to experience. And there's a reason, this is going to be almost humorous, that if you look at the alphabet and at grammar, there's a reason why humans were called hunter-gatherers and not gatherer-hunters.
Tell me the, I love breaking down the language and the words. It usually has a greater meaning that we're not picking up on, so school me.
Well, if you look at the English language and, you know, you're doing a hyphenated word like that, oftentimes the convention would be to, you know, go in alphabetical order, which would be G before H or gatherer before hunter. But another way of looking at that is primary and secondary. And so, you know, hunting, you know, has been shown across, you know, populations that have been studied, and obviously anthropology and archaeology, that this is what we did more. And it was the hunting for and consuming of meat, which allowed for, you know, our massive brain growth and our evolution to, you know, increase, you know, tool fabrication and usage and many other things.
Interesting. So it definitely had to be, because that was the primary or perhaps the most scarce and most important. Interesting. Anything else when you're sort of reflecting back on, you know, humankind and our growth and development as a species, as a beast, in relation to hunting?
Oh, certainly. And, you know, whether we look at the theories based on some of the sciences I just mentioned, you know, like archaeology or anthropology, you know, as far as we have in history, we know that amongst amongst tribes, ourselves included, you know, the hunter was the warrior and really was the original athlete.
Well, yeah, John, I mean, not only was, but had to be. I mean, if you weren't fast enough, you didn't eat. If you weren't, you know, more capable, then you just suffered. And it was, you know, perhaps the word athlete that is attached to, and, you know, present day times, voluntary pursuit, but in terms of what the demands on the body, you really had to be, otherwise you were not eating.
Yeah. And this was all very, not even thought about and just intertwined into the spiritual nature. So hunting was a role of great significance, obviously for the survival of the tribe. And that craft was approached with much reverence and ritual. And, you know, that's how I do it. And that's how my friends do it today.
Well, let's talk about that, especially in relation to, you know, what you do or what we're doing here with the Lifetime Athlete. Let's talk about the role of training for the hunting athlete and where it fits in and how you think about that.
Yeah, when you look again at history that we know of, the tradition was always to train and prepare for the hunt, excuse me, to have the greatest chance of success. And so there were various skills and senses that needed to be honed. And that's a primal tradition to establish mental as well as physical readiness. But
I'm sorry to interrupt there, John. When you say that, you know, tradition was to train, prepare, what are you talking about there?
Usually we're talking about the hunters, you know, they were typically men, and obviously the young boys, they were at a point where they were too young to go, but eventually as they were on their journey to become man, you know, many of those rites of passage and rituals involved conditioning, you know, via games and other quests and competency, both, you know, in the field in terms of survival and knowledge of things, but also athleticism was expected and demanded.
Right. So you're saying expected sort of culturally, and demanded culturally from, you know, parents or peers, or, I mean, certainly just from the rigors of the actual hunt itself.
Yeah. I don't even know if this is going to make any sense, but, you know, if a hunt was coming together and let's say, you know, the leader of that expedition was selecting a few key players, he might look around the cave, and if he saw somebody who was, you know, kind of not in the best of health, laying in the corner, drinking Mountain Dew, playing video games, he probably would have passed that person by. And then this dude that was super jacked, who was pumping rocks, and, you know, okay, you get the picture.
Oh, so you're saying it is that you know, that classic trope, the image of, you know, being selected on the playground, really goes back as well. Just Which does make sense. And again, you know, it's not about any sort of a, you know, a judgment or like value judgment, but it is just about capability. That makes sense. All right, I'm tracking. Carry on.
So this is kind of where I get a chance to talk about, you know, one of our ebook programs. And this is a Lifetime Athlete program now, formerly Lifetime Body program, fit for the field. And so it's really designed for today's hunting athlete. And it's what I used to be able to do what I did and enjoy it and not get destroyed. I'm very grateful for that. But it's a program that really fills a very specific niche for the, you know, the hunting enthusiast, particularly for the backcountry hunter.
Tell me about it, John.
So the genesis, you know, I'm going to tell you, it was about 15 years ago. Okay. So, you know, so I'm 55 now. So I would have been, you know, 40-ish, and some of my peers and I were, you know, fairly fit people, fairly athletic. A lot of people were involved in running in different ways and some other sports, but some of us on a national level. And we noticed, well, gosh, we're fit, but we're not fit in the right way. Because when we go out there to do these hunts, like I described with, you know, the 10,000 vertical, 15 miles off trail loads, it's like, oh man, my body is just stiff and sore. And I, you know, and then maybe if you got something, you got to deal with all the positions you do with dealing with it and then carrying some really heavy loads. Well, I started to think about that. And so I did an analysis of what are the unique demands of the backcountry hunter in terms of conditioning, in terms of, you know, being able to own and manage different body positions, all that kneeling, squatting, crouching types of things, you know, how much you need to have carrying ability, grip strength. There's some really unique things that you don't quite get in a standard gym workout. And so that's where I go to application. You know, I created this program. It's a 12-week program. It takes you step by step through both a conditioning workout and then a hiking progression so that, you know, you can go out there in the season and do those things, you know, maximally, and just be the human beast that you are, you know, genetically engineered to be.
Exactly. And I think just to, if we go back to what you started this little segment on, so you're 40 and you were very fit, in terms of your, you know, endurance and the group of people that you were, your peers at the time. So it wasn't like you were going from, you know, the couch to hunting and that you were finding that difficult. You just were fit at a high level, but in the wrong ways. And that's how you needed to adapt. So I just think it's an important distinction that, you know, you were generally considered to be very fit. It just didn't have the right match in terms of what this really demanding hunting excursions required of you.
Yeah, and sometimes we call that in our field the, you know, sports specific fitness. You want to have the mm-hmm. tools that you need for the goals that you are pursuing. And so regarding fit for the field, you know, since I've been using that and having groups train with it, you know, I couldn't have done and be doing the things I'm doing at this point without it. And I wanted to really help many people to enjoy those same pursuits for many years to come with less fatigue, less discomfort. So here's the thing. It is somewhat specific to the hunting athlete, but then if we go back to our previous conversation, it's also fit for, it's kind of consistent with human evolution, and it's a hell of a good workout for anybody that wants to kick ass.
Yeah, or, I mean, you know, kick ass or be in the mountains or, you know, have to travel great distances and carry heavy loads. I think there's a ton of applications where, you know, a body that's hardy and strong like that can be capable in.
Yeah. And with a few tweaks, you know, I've made this thing work for people who were skiers or basketball players or, you know, even distance runners. You know, when I can convince them to run a little less and do a bit more of, you know, comprehensive training, we oftentimes improve their health and their performance. So it's really an interesting thing. I don't want to say any more about that, but if you want to check it out, obviously Fit for the Field. It's a program. There's a program menu item on the Lifetime Athlete. Check it out.
I like it. And that actually makes me think about the pursuit of hunting generally, but what it means in terms of nutrition and meat consumption. And I know that this is something that you have, you know, really thought about a lot and have some thoughts on, but just in respect to actually specifically meat consumption, because ultimately, you know, that's something that if you're lucky to harvest a wapiti comes from your pursuits. Where does that fit into sort of your worldview and your philosophies on this topic?
Yeah, I think that I've been studying that science quite a bit. And so I obviously, you know, there's always the N equals one when I kind of look at what I do or what works or doesn't work for me, but there's a broader, you know, set of principles that I think we all should be open-minded and non-biased about. And that's things that relate to human biology and evolution. So having said that, I would say right away that what a can of worms meat consumption becomes as a topic. It's a vast topic and there's a lot of controversy and emotion wrapped up in it. But animal-based nutrition has really been the foundation of human existence, you know, over, you know, those 2+ million years. And that's the very first thing we all have to look at is like, yeah, you know, there probably weren't any year-round salad bars and devout long-surviving mm-hmm. vegan populations in human ancestry for 2 million years. That's pretty much fact. And I want to just get that out there to say that's not condemning to anybody, but just to understand what really the science is.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, that makes sense. So take me a little further.
Okay. So looking at the best science that we've got today, which you know, science always has the goal, right, of being less wrong over time. You know, that's one of the founding principles of the scientific method. And so anytime a hypothesis is generated, the goal of a good researcher is to try to prove it wrong. Eventually, if they fail at proving it wrong enough, they eventually think that, okay, well, this might, you know, reach a theoretical level or beyond. So in relationship to the equator, we're pretty much at the equator, very close to it. A lot of the studies are now showing that animal products made up 65 to 70% of the human diet, that leaving 30 to 35% for plant matter. And then the further away from the equator, north or south, one went, you know, towards the polar regions, then that really moved up to about 95% animal intake, 5% plant intake in the evolutionary human diet.
Interesting. Okay.
So then we take a look at anatomy of the human, of the, you know, the GI tract, metabolism, you know, the teeth, the jaws, some of these things. We look at a field of medical anthropology. We look at paleoarchaeology. You know, this is where a lot of this data is coming from. Humans may be considered, and I want you to take me to task on these words, as facultative or preferential carnivores, but obligate herbivores.
I'm not taking you to task. I'm tracking.
Okay. So if I even try to explain that a little bit, I think if we look at the patterns that we have with, you know, the study of the human existence and even some of the primitive, you know, hunter-gatherer cultures, which still exist today, although there are some problems, you know, with any of that literature because they're not really roaming free and hunting at will because of laws and things that they once did. So we need to know this, but a preferential carnivore would be one that's like, well, I know, or I sense inside that, you know, an animal product most of the time is what I'm going to eat because it's going to have the most bioavailable nutrition and the most, let's say, nutritional bang for buck, you know, energy, et cetera. That's what a preferential carnivore would be. And then an obligate herbivore is a human who has developed the capacity to eat plant matter and get some, you know, nutrition from that. And so thus what we really are, we humans are opportunistic omnivores, you know, kind of like pigs and bears. You know, we'll eat whatever we can to survive. But that brings up the question of thrive, you know, is surviving thriving? And so that's where a lot of these arguments on diet come from. You know, you can survive on a junk food diet, but we know that's not thriving. Well, now, you know, people are looking very closely at, well, how much meat or how much plant matter might make up the ideal personal diet, and I hesitate to say ideal human diet, because I think there should be some variance.
Sure, sure. And I think that, you know, this is, I can sense even a sort of pause or reservation in your voice to get to, you know, to plant a flag in the ground. But John, I just, you know, just keep, this is based on science, your perspectives. And I think that, you know, while it may not be controversial, you know, there's difference of opinions out there. I just want to learn what you're thinking about this. And there is a conversation going on between carnivores, plant-based nutrition. It is a hot topic, to say the least.
Yeah, I'd even say it's a virtual war. You know, there's a lot of name calling, and there's also, you know, emotional grabbing on with bias to bits of the literature and then twisting it. And you know, that's really a tough thing. But, you know, when you look at the carnivores and the plant-based camps, you know, obviously you can name some names that are popular right now, you know, promoting that. In fact, there's that recent movie Game Changers. What a piece of crap, you know, vegan propaganda turd that was.
And was it really? I saw a trailer for that, but I was wondering when that would sort of cross your, did you watch that?
Yeah, I did. And you know, and bummer, man, Arnold sold out. You know, I'm kind of pissed about that too, to be honest. You can tell my voice is, you know, I feel it, because this is bad, because it's a glossy, well-made movie and a lot of less informed people are going to see it and then ultimately form opinions or make decisions that may not be best for their health and performance. So that's right. My thing there. Again, you know, we got to be science and common sense first. And so here's some of the questions that I would just like to propose. And I don't know that I'm going to, you know, have an answer, but is plant-based nutrition better, safer, cleaner, more nourishing, and environmentally sound. You know, that's some of the positions that many people will say. Well, the best research today does not support that position.
Okay. That's interesting, because you get a lot of publicity out there that it is all those things.
Yeah. And obviously we could do hours and hours of a show just on that one statement. And, you know, people have various, very strong beliefs that those things are true. And oftentimes, you know, their morals and intertwine, there's some ethics and emotion with that. And then that's a tough one. So then the next question that I would ask is, did we historically eat plants as sustenance between animal sourced feedings?
What's the answer there?
Well, it's, again, I don't think anybody knows. And so you have to be careful of any expert who's really confident, you know, but there's quite a bit of data to suggest that given a choice, humans are going for animal products. And, you know, when you look at the woolly mammoth or the mastodon, which was a giant, we're called megafauna, you know, a beast, three times the size of a modern African elephant, you know, that was a lot of food there. And so one of the theories is that, well, in between mastodon kills, because, you know, you didn't always get one, right? Until, again, they went extinct. And there used to be the thought that that was the Ice Age. Now more of the data suggests that we just killed them all off because they were so good to eat. But anyway, back onto this question. Okay, well, we have to develop as an organism. We have to survive. So, okay, now we're going to scratch and claw and we're going to eat some, well, crickets, you know, or we're going to have some tubers or any of the, you know, any plant matter we could find that wasn't poisonous. And so, you know, there is that model, you know, that question that, you know, that's how plants got into the human diet, because we found a way to use them to survive in between eating the meat that really helped us to thrive.
That makes sense. I'm tracking. Okay.
Yeah, it seems to make sense. I, you know, like I say, I don't know everything. Now we ask ourselves this: do we have a ceiling of tolerance, which is perhaps genetically limited, for the compounds in plants known as anti-nutrients? So all those things like lectins and phytates and oxalates, and others. And so when we intake those things in small doses, it's called xenohormesis. So a little bit. You know, it's almost like a flu shot. You know, it's not enough to kill you, but it makes you stronger so that you can, again, you know, adapt and coexist with this intake. I don't know that answer. I do know that I've done some personal experiments on myself and with others, and we said, well, okay, let's just explore what's the best amount of plant intake, you know. And I tried eating lots and lots of plant intake. Actually didn't feel as good, had inflammation markers go up. But I don't eat a total carnivore diet. I eat some plant matter. I don't think carbs are evil. I just think carbs need to be used strategically. And so that's kind of where I'm at. But my whole point, you know, in this question is, you know, we've all been led to believe, you know, plant matter, particularly vegetables, you know, again, maybe fruits, not so much on grains. You just can't have too much. It's the bounty of the earth, and it's good for you, and it's so rich with micronutrients. But that doesn't make sense biologically. Everything works on a bell-shaped curve.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, just a couple more questions, because I know this can be mind-spinning. Or did we eat plants because they are rich in certain micronutrients like you know, minerals and vitamins, and have these medicinal properties which we grew to learn to need and crave and seek out and attack when they were seasonally available? That's also possible.
Okay, so it's possible, but basically all these questions are sort of stacking on top of one another as I'm listening to you walk through. Keep going.
Yeah, and very rhetorical, but now I say this. Is that why people who are what we call nose-to-tail carnivorous eaters, you know, again, whether those are indigenous peoples or modern practicers of that approach, Is that why they do what they do, for complete nutrition? You know, in other words, if you eat the organs, you know, and, you know, the bone marrow, and even some, you know, cultures will eat the partially digested plant matter from the entrails. You know, is that because that's how you get complete nutrition if you only eat animals? Or is it just an efficiency and no waste thing where, hey, we've got this source of nutrition, we're going to use everything so that we can conserve energy till we have to go, kind of risk life and health to get another one?
Right. Okay. Gotcha. So when you think about all these questions, competing ideologies, beliefs, programs, books, where does it shake out?
So ultimately, there's a lot these days that is not known. And I said before, beware of those that swear, it's just one way and that they're so confident that they know. So when I look at things, I look at humans as beasts on Earth, so I see that picture of planet Earth and, the human is, fits within the ecosystem. And that's why, the lifetime athlete and formerly the lifetime body use what I call the planet-based diet. And so it's a simple set of characteristics where we just don't eat junk or processed crap because we know that, the literature is so strong that's just not doing you any health favors. We try to eat, whole, fresh, local, seasonal, organic, all those kinds of words, that kind of food, that you can source and afford. And then you decide through experiments and through, intelligent study, how much plant versus animal intake works best for you. But appreciate the science, which strongly suggests that animal products are essential as opposed to being optional for optimal human health.
Mm. John, I like that. That is a very practical, actionable recommendation. You're staying away from junk food, you keep it fresh, seasonal, organic, all the buzzwords for just nutrient-rich food, and then do some self-experimentation to find that mixture for yourself. So, let's bring it back a little bit to hunting. And some of our listeners may or may not have experience or exposure to wild game. And there are some interesting things I think to learn about meat consumption, nutrition, looking at it through the lens of wild game itself.
Born to be wild. Okay, so let's play a little game here. Sure. If I was a marching canine, what would I be?
Marching. I don't know, John.
I'd be Steppenwolf, brother, and that's who sings that song. Get your motor running. Okay, so I think that, and I'm a wolf anyway from the animal fit, so this really fits well. But so we talk about those benefits of wild game. Well, when procured via hunting, it completes that circle, the primal circle of food. And really that's something that we all need to appreciate. There's a whole process for getting our nutrition and meat doesn't come from the grocery store. And I think it's sometimes good to know that and immerse yourself in that very human experience.
Absolutely. Tell us more about, what that means to you.
Yeah. Well, having said that, I'm going to say this. I'm going to say you don't have to hunt if you don't want to. But if you do, it's very important to all my hunting colleagues out there. We keep these ancient traditions alive, of respect and reverence for the animals, and also preparation for going out there. And most people do, I have to say.
Okay. Got it.
So next up, I'd say if you don't hunt, it's a great idea to befriend and support that ethical hunter who actually plays a large part in wildlife conservation.
Okay, so, talk to me more about that.
Yeah,
just in case someone doesn't, live in that world.
So I'm going to dance around on that one a little bit. So first of all, I'd say, most years I do end up harvesting several animals. And I think one of the important parts of the human journey is to share, and so I you've been involved in those meat drops when I'm dropping meat off at your place, but also sharing and feeding others and dining and having that rich tradition, based around, the bounty of the earth. Okay. These are important things. And we just had Thanksgiving dinner. So that's very, nice to mention that. But I'd also say this, that a lot of people aren't aware of is that, not only are a lot of, these really avid, ethical hunters, particularly these backcountry hunters, they're very knowledgeable and interested in population preservation, you know, wildlife conservation, population management, you know, that some of that's enacted through the hunting and through the local, you know, state agencies, but really through the taxes and donations, hunters are the greatest funding source for wildlife conservation in the country, not anti-hunters.
Interesting. Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. And in fact, there's something that's called the Pittman-Robertson Act, which is a tax, that, you know, is placed on all, you know, like hunting and, you know, outdoor related equipment and bows and, you know, firearms and things like that. And so, you know, there's a portion of every purchase that a hunter makes, in addition to, so let's say, you know, licenses and tags and those sorts of things, that go to actually, you know, preserving habitat and funding various operations and studies. So really, really cool to mention that, because I think a lot of people are, you know, there's always that thing, if you're going to be critical, you're welcome to be critical as long as you're going to do something, you know, but if you're going to sit back and do nothing and make claims where maybe you're not fully aware of things, it's good to study.
Got, well, absolutely. And applies to just everything.
Life. Yep. Lifetime athlete. So the other thing, maybe the last thing on meat, because, you know, I love cooking and sharing and that sort of thing. It's lean as hell in most cases. And so you need to cook it either, you know, fast and rare, depending on the cut, or low and slow. And you probably, when you're looking at your platter, are going to need to add some fat, because most of it's so lean, there's just no fat. Because if you eat lean protein in excess, you can get what's known as rabbit starvation, because you're just not getting the essential fatty acids that you need.
Rabbit starvation?
Yeah, it's a term.
What do they call that?
Well, because, you know, like a rabbit's just nibbling on, you know, well, not, you know, grass, but like it came from kind of like the bodybuilding community at first before the scientific community picked it up. It's like, you know, if you're just eating chicken breasts and broccoli, eventually you develop problems. Sure, it's a great way to get lean in the short run, but not the long run for health.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's take this home. Well, I guess the last thing that I think it's appropriate to weave this all together is talking about meat, but meat for health and then meat for athletes. I know that you have thoughts on this, and I think it would be a nice way to tie everything that we've chopped up today together.
Just like Ronnie sang, be my little baby.
Oh, rest, hey, taking power. It home. Shout, yeah, out. Shout
the
out
late,
to
Eddie great
Money.
Eddie Money.
Oh, yeah, man.
Love you, man. So, you know, meat, as far as athletes go and for health. Now, this is near and dear to me, because, you know, I work with a lot of these lifetime athletes. But, you know, one of the things we manipulate is diet. And, you know, and I do, just to be fair, I have some vegan athletes, and you know, you can succeed on that. It's just not easy, and in the long run there may be a few percentage points less optimal. But not going there, what I'm going to say is this: I want to advocate for meat consumption for every human, and at least animal products, to include eggs, fowl, shellfish, whatever sources that, you know, you will consume. And I also say this, though, that red meat is scientifically proven to be the most nutrient dense and anti-allergenic, anti-inflammatory food in existence for humans. And that's very consistent with what we talked about with, you know, the mastodons.
Well, absolutely. It sounds like it's, you know, cooked into our DNA.
Yeah, you're made to eat that stuff. Now, if you don't want to, that's your choice. But I just want to get that out there. Now, when I say, okay, we've got these athletes, I respect anyone who's got that strong ethical position. But I also want to ask them to open-mindedly delve into the science, as opposed to dogma and emotion. You know, that's really important when you're making decisions that can impact your long-term health and performance, that you're doing so from a science and common sense perspective, not necessarily an ill-founded, wrong in science, emotional one.
Sure. And I think that, you know, when I'm stepping back to consider, you know, this, maybe it's a dilemma, or that just this, a moment like this, where you're balancing, you know, what you believe and what you feel versus what the science says, I think it's important to separate the two. And that's exactly what you're saying here, is that don't mix them all up together. So your dogma and your emotion is coloring scientific facts, or the opposite. So I think that's a good that's a good general lesson, but specifically with nutrition in the really noisy, crowded mind space of 2019, it seems more and more applicable than ever.
Yeah, I mean, doing what you said, which would be the inappropriate choice, would be, and have a camera with you. Now you've filmed Game Changers 2. So down with that, man. So here's the thing. I don't know what I don't know, you know, and I only know what I know right now. Those things come from my own experiences and from much study of the latest science on these topics. But I can suggest that every athlete will benefit from some meat in their diet. And here's why. That protein is the most bioavailable. So more so than soy, hemp, pea protein, by far, rich in omega-3 fatty acids in many cases, zinc, heme iron, vitamin B12, vitamin D, vitamin K2, things that you can't get either can't get them at all or can't convert the plant matter very easily into those bioavailable things that you need, and several other constituents as well, things that make powerful humans. So that's going to help an athlete to grow, to recover more quickly from training stresses, make those adaptations, repair more efficiently. And that's particularly true over the long term. And I know I'm rambling, but I've got to say this. There's a lot of people, like even with that Game Changers deal where, you know, a person goes on a plant-based diet and they actually very briefly preserve performance, but then it starts to drop. And there's a fair amount of good data out there that says, you know, performance tanks over time if you don't get animal nutrition into your human beast.
John, that's fascinating. And I do think that you and I have talked about this before, is that if you begin a new nutritional program and you're adding additional thoughtfulness and attention to detail and really just more attention to nutrition in general, you tend to get an uptick regardless of what that program is. And so it does make sense that if you adopt some of those plant-based principles initially, and what you're doing is cutting out, the negative factors, you're going to get that uptick. But then, you know, zooming out, looking at the long term, what I think is pretty interesting about what you just said is that the protein, just looking at it from what your body pulls out of meat proteins, it is very democratic in that though the things that you listed through from the omega-3s all the way to the K-12s, that's just what happens. It's a process that unfolds, and there is no, your body's not making any sort of value-based, there's no dogma and emotion to what your body pulls out of the nutrition that's placed in there. What you're saying is just basically fact, and it's fact that you can use to make decisions.
Yeah, quick response to that, and I agree with you quite a bit, well, entirely, but if you look at the three macronutrients, protein, fat, and carbohydrate, protein is essentially, it's the building block that we make most of our tissues out of, those amino acids. The body does have a way in survival mode to convert either muscle protein that it strips or ingested protein into glucose. So we can make a little glucose from protein, but that's not really its desired purpose. Protein is the building block. Now, fat is a dual source macro because it's both a fuel source as well as a building block for, our nervous tissue, our brain, hormones, etc. So we use fat doubly. But carbs are only a fuel source, for them almost entirely. So when you look at that, the protein that humans, based on our biology, we make human protein best from animal protein. That's fact. And when we look at our diet, I'm working on a little project. I think it might be called athletic fueling. That's going to be an early 2020 type of thing. We have to look at those levers, and protein probably shouldn't change very much. Obviously if a person's in a growth phase, maybe a little bit more protein is going to be valuable, but we, fairly high all the time, literature is very supportive of that these days, but fat's a lever that we can utilize, and also carbs. So carbs can be used strategically when we need to, let's say, replenish muscle glycogen. If you're doing a lot of glycolytic exercise, if you're trying to gain weight, carbs are actually a great key if you want to gain weight, and if particularly liquid carbs, So if you're a Jamba Juice person and you want to gain weight, awesome. If you want to lose weight, maybe drive past. And finally, just coming back to the fat, fat is an interesting thing because if you eat, you know, a diet that starts to look very ketogenic, and in other words, it's mostly fat and protein, you know, you're going to be producing ketones. In the long run, you typically lose weight on a diet like that because, you know, ultimately you're very feeling much satiety, you're full, you don't eat as much food or calories, and that's just how it works. So anyway, long-winded, and I'm going to say, hey guys, with this one, I would really love your comments and impressions. I welcome your input, and I would encourage you to post questions that can be addressed on this topic on the show. I'll even invite you on for a friendly discussion or testimonial or even debate, which is always going to be classy, so don't worry. We could share, and we do it from a science perspective, we could share research papers and explore popular opinions or media content on this topic. I don't have all the answers, but I think I've got a few of them. And if you love this information, please give us a 5-star rating and a quick review wherever you listen to the show, but particularly on Apple Podcasts /iTunes, because you know that's the ladder that we're trying to climb with this show to reach and help more folks. Athletes have been hunters and meat eaters for life, and lifetime athletes will benefit from some meat in their diet, whether they hunted for it on the mountain or in the grocery store. And that's all I've got to say.
Adios, everyone.
Peace out.